From the studios of Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP, in Santa Cruz, California, I'm Gary Shapiro, and this is From the Bookshelf. Helen Schulman is my guest. She's the author of the novels A Day at the Beach and P.S. Her latest novel is This Beautiful Life. She's also on the creative writing faculty of the New School. Helen Schulman, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Thank you so much for having me.
There's a lot to talk about after reading This Beautiful Life, but since it's a novel and I don't want to reveal everything, I'll let you tell our audience what you think they should know about the book.
Well, my book is about a family that's recently moved to Manhattan from a university town where they had a pretty good life. They're very happy. And then the father is offered a much bigger job in New York, helping to develop a university there. So they move. The mother is an art historian, but she's not working. She's a stay-at-home mom at the time. And they have two kids, a 15-and-a-half-year-old boy named Jake and a little girl named Coco, who's six. And they've been enrolled in kind of a fancy private school. And one Friday night, Jake's invited to a party. His mom checks it out. It's supposed to be chaperoned, but it turns out it isn't. And he goes, and when he's there, a girl that he really quite likes goes off with another guy, and he hooks up with the hostess of the party, an eighth grader named Daisy. And when Daisy wants to take it a little further, Jake says, "No, I can't. You're too young," and he goes home. And the next morning when he wakes up, in his inbox is an email from Daisy saying, "Do you still think I'm too young?" And attached is a video of her performing a sexual act. And he's stunned, freaked out, maybe has some pride, doesn't know what to do with it. It's a hot potato. He forwards it to his best friend, who forwards it to two friends, and they forward it, and before you know it, it's gone completely viral. It's all over, not only the city, but the world, and their little world explodes.
Yeah. So, you know, kids have always made mistakes and done stupid or unthinking things, but I guess the potential for doing grander stupid things is there now.
Well, I think that's true. I mean, it's almost like that's their biological imperative. I mean, that's their job, is kind of to be passionate and not to think ahead and to feel that they're immortal. And, I mean, it's true when I was a teenager, and it's true now. It's just a situation like this. You know, I grew up in the 70s. A situation like this might have had some Polaroid pictures and two fathers who beat each other up behind a local bar. You know, I mean, here what happens is it's so instantly out of the kids' control, and it's so permanent because the Internet, at least now, has doesn't forget, and it's so irretrievable that the damage is big, and the parents respond in a huge way, and the kids are dwarfed by the response, by the reaction, and the punishment really is much, much bigger than the crime.
Now, it's interesting that you just use the word crime, because I guess when Jake forwards that video, he is committing a crime.
That is really, you know, that's part of the book, and it's something I've learned a lot more about recently as states are changing their legislation. But if you send a sex, for example, and you're an adult, you're over 18, it's legal if you and the subject of the sex and the person receiving it are all over 18. But if anybody involved is under 18, then it's considered child pornography, disseminating pornography. And then from state to state, the laws change. So in some states now, you could, let's say, you're dating, a boy is dating a girl, and he's 18 and she's 16, and she sends him a naked picture, and he sends it to a friend. He could get sexual offender status, and that could follow him for years into his 40s, a point where he could have trouble getting an apartment, or he can't live near any place where kids gather and have a hard time getting a job and going to school. You know, so it can, something that looks like a youthful indiscretion can really follow you. On the other hand, as we also sadly know now, in cases of cyberbullying, you know, kids are so tormented sometimes to the point of suicide.
Well, let me just say something about sexting. I want to ask you about, you know, it's
isn't it just sort of modern flirting? I mean, that's, everybody uses the technology that's available to them. You know, I mean, you might have passed a note in your class, which would have been pretty much the same thing.
Well, I think, I mean, some kids look at it that way. You know, I teach, in the summers I teach college students, during the year I teach graduate students. And I was talking about it with my students this summer, and some said, it's like, well, if you like somebody and they like you, they'll say, send me a picture. And it is a form of flirting. I mean, the problem is, though, that then there are naked pictures of you out there, and other people say you're a slut and a whore and you can't get a job, and it gets passed around and kids get tormented. But I do think that, you know, mores change. I mean, there was an article I read this summer in Time magazine by a writer, Belinda Luscombe, who said that the University of Rhode Island did a little study amongst their students, and of the students they queried, 56% had said that they had either sent or received a text or an email with intimate images attached. And of that 56%, one-fifth admitted to forwarding it. So that's a lot of kids, because they're just admitting there. You know, I mean, it's a small sample, but I think it is becoming part of the culture. You know, the problem is that these things follow you when you want to get a job, or just even in a small hometown. I mean, some of the stories I've read have been so painful. You know, kids who can't, they switch schools, and the picture comes to the new school.
Well, you know, I remember when I was a little kid, my parents would say, you know, you missed the golden age of radio. That's when you had to use your imagination, and you sit there in front of that idiot box, and it's just not as good. You know, you missed it. And when I, you know, became an adult, I would look and see kids, you know, watching videotapes, or their parents videotaping their party, and I was thinking, you know, they missed it. You know, they missed when The Wizard of Oz was a special thing that was only on once a year, because they can, by the time they've you reach the age of three, they've watched it 6,000 times on video. And it seems to me that they don't treasure their life as much because, you know, daddy is taping it all and they can always rewind and watch it again. But at the same time, I started thinking, well, you know, that's just crazy because kids have the life that they have. They live in the era that they live in, and they have the nostalgia that's dished out to them, and they have the technology that's available to them. And so I guess we live in this world. Now, the Internet is here, right?
It's totally here, and a lot of it's great, and some of it's really exciting. It's just got pitfalls, you know, and some of them are big. I mean, I'm certainly not against the Internet. I'm not against anything. I was just trying to write a story about the way we live now.
Right.
But there are dangers to it. There are great things that come out of it, too. I mean, think about the Arab Spring, you know, as nonviolent as something like that could be. But then think about the riots in London, you know, which were perpetuated by social networking. So,
well, with every good thing, you have something equally bad.
Yeah, I think just the thing about this is how big the instrument is. I mean, I think for good or ill, it's really huge. You know, a kid can take a picture of herself in her room, and it can be all over the world, and you can't get it back. So it makes us all super powerful in a way.
And it makes our mistakes, you know, super huge.
Right.
Well, you know, it used to be, and I teach middle school, by the way. 20 years ago or so, when I was first a middle school teacher, I was trained in a class that we offered. It was called Quest. And it was a decision-making skills class for young people in which you really went through a process of how you make your decisions and how these decisions will affect the people around you and what you should do before making a decision and so forth. But, you know, you can't test that on the standardized test. And in the era of No Child Left Behind, that curriculum has been long abandoned. So I think really we need to think about how we're teaching kids about the decisions that they make.
Well, I mean, you know, the whole question of privacy is changing and shame is changing. And it's not just kids. Like, I live in New York and we had Anthony Weiner, right, a congressman.
Yeah.
Who could very easily been our mayor. Mm-hmm. Very smart guy, very sophisticated, you know, clearly knew the dangers, you know, he didn't need his mom to tell him, but somehow forgot it in the privacy of his office or his room. You know, I think there's something about being in front of a machine and not another person that makes you forget that it's not private. And kids, I don't even think about privacy that much until it's blown.
Right.
But it's a very, you know, privacy is a precious thing, and once it's lost, it's lost. So.
Well, of course, that's a lot, but not just privacy, but there are so many things that kids, and by kids I mean young people, not just middle schoolers, but young people, don't think about today that we used to think about. You know, I mean, they don't think about their name and what their name, you know, what the value of that is, their good name kind of thing. They don't think about... the other day I went to see The Help, and there was a couple of girls, high school girls, I would reckon, sitting a couple of rows ahead of me, and they were enjoying the movie a lot, but they were also making it difficult for others to enjoy the movie because they were talking and texting and making a racket. And when the movie was over, I went up to them and I said, you know, you guys were really selfish. I'm glad you enjoyed the movie, but, you know, do you have to wreck the movie for others? And they looked at me, you know, completely shocked because it just hadn't occurred to them that that was the case.
I wonder if they would change their behavior next time. Did they apologize to you? Or?
They did.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know. But, I mean, you know, I mean, just in general, kids seem to know a lot less about things than... I mean, they know a lot more about certain things than we ever knew, you know, because of they grew up in the age of AIDS, and they've had sexual education, and they've had access to pornography on the internet and all that stuff. So they know, like, all kinds of stuff that I didn't even dream about till I was about 30. But at the same time, they really don't know some of these key things that we've been talking about.
Yeah, well, their parents don't. I mean, at least in my book, the parents make some bad mistakes, too. So I think it's just, you know, I think that I was really trying to think about the earthquake and the culture of technology and how the technological revolution really is as big or bigger, I think. I know it may sound hyperbolic, as the Industrial Revolution. But it's really changing the way that we interact in every way. And even when I was in grad school, I worked as an assistant to a neurologist, so I have a little pet interest in that area and absolutely no expertise, but it is also changing, you know, the way our brain functions. So it's big.
We're talking with Helen Schulman, and her latest novel is called This Beautiful Life. Well, there's so much to know now that I think in some ways it's easier to just say, well, there's too much to know, so I'll just know nothing. I mean, because kids know that you can look it up on Wikipedia, then why learn stuff? I mean, have you encountered any of that sort of philosophy among your college students?
Thank God, no. I mean, I really am lucky. I've had wonderful students. You know, I teach creative writing and literature, and they're all so excited about what they're doing that they've been pretty rewarding to work with. So, no, I haven't found an anti-intellectualism like that.
Mm-hmm. Maybe it's just out here in California. You New Yorker. Well, let's talk a little bit about parenting, because parents are main characters in your novel, too. How did this story play out in your head? Did you know what was going to happen to everybody, and then you wrote it, or did you find them doing things while you were writing about them?
Oh, I absolutely did not know what was going to happen to them. In fact, the world was changing so rapidly as I was writing it that I almost regretted picking a topic that was so current and zeitgeisty, you know, because I didn't know how to end the book. I didn't quite know what the ramifications would be because they were changing so much. I mean, just as you've suggested, something, I set the book in 2003 where an incident like this would be one of the first in a community. But of course now they're not. We read about it all the time. So, you know, people's attitudes toward it all changes. So that was part of it, was just trying to keep up with the way the world was moving. And then, you know, I was very attached to my characters. It was really hard to hurt them. And some of them are wounded in very deep ways by the end of the book, and that took a lot of effort on my part to do that to characters that I care about so much. But I was surprised. I think the parents surprised themselves. I think this is basically a good family. They're nice kids. The parents love each other. They've done basically good work in the world, and they find themselves under siege doing things they never thought that they would. And I think a lot of parents can relate to that, the idea of your child being endangered. You feel like you would do anything. But in their efforts to do anything, they undermine his welfare because they never give him a chance take responsibility for himself and to work some of it through himself and be his own person. So he really becomes crippled by their power in the community and their relationship with the media and, you know, the big guns that the father pulls out at the mother's behest.
Do you think you focus more on Jake than Daisy?
Well, Daisy, really, she has a little piece in the book. It's at the very end and at the very beginning. And I hope that her presence is felt throughout. So, yes, that's true, but I really wanted at the end for people to understand what this cost her and where it left her. You know, I have a lot of affection for Daisy. I think she's a very deprived, brave girl, you know, who's longing for connection and you know, is taught that this is the way girls get it.
You know, nowadays little girls are dancing around to Beyonce and Katy Perry, and there's some pretty sexual models out there for middle school students, Lady Gaga and so forth.
I feel that way. You know, I mean, I grew up in the 60s and the 70s, and, you know, it was like the height of feminism. And I was pretty surprised to, you know, be raising children in a time when it was really hard to find my daughter, when she was younger, a party dress that didn't look like it was appropriate for a prostitute. You know? And I'm hardly a conservative person in any way. But
yeah.
I do think that little girls are overly sexualized and commodified, and that's what they're taught. That's what they see all the time. They see it, you know, in magazines, movies, videos. They see it in the way people dress. They see it in the way they're dressed. So the characters in my book, that's part of how they see themselves. And they see that is the locus of their value and power, even when they're very young. And that gets them into trouble, but it makes no, you know, it doesn't come out of the sky blue that these are some of the choices that they make.
And it's getting younger and younger all the time.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think Daisy's an eighth grader in your book, but now it could happen to a sixth grader or something.
Oh.
Possibly, I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know.
Well, so do you see your book as a cautionary tale or what?
Well, it's funny. I mean, I didn't set out to do that, you know. I mean, I'm a novelist. I had a lot of ideas I wanted to explore. I was really interested in post-9/11 American culture and the family and, you know, sex roles and, oh, the rush to greed that led to the banking crisis. I mean, I had a lot of things in my head. But what's been interesting since the book has come out is how many people have come up to me and said, you know, I read your book, I gave it to my kid, and then we talked about it. And it's been really good. And I thought, wow, I mean, I didn't set out to write a cautionary tale. I set out to write about the way we live now, but some people have found that it's useful for discussion, and that's fine with me.
Sure. It's nice to have people talk about your book.
Yeah.
We're talking with Helen Schulman, and her latest novel is called This Beautiful Life. Why is it called This Beautiful Life, by the way?
Well, the family has a beautiful life, and they live in a time where people, in a place where people look like they have beautiful lives. And yet, like every life, it's the kind of house of cards, and it gets jeopardized. And in their efforts also to really get more, they end up with less.
So now it's been, this is the 10th anniversary now of 9/11, and you've written your kind of 9/11 book, right? A Day at the Beach.
Yes, my book before this took place on 9/11. It was called A Day at the Beach.
And what can we talk about that book for a little bit? What's the reaction been to that book?
Well, it was interesting. I mean, now it's, you know, it's been out for a long time now. I guess it came out in 2007. I know when I first started writing it, people were like, "Oh my God, you can't write about 9/11." I mean, that was so long ago. And then by the time I finished writing it, people were like, "Oh my God, there are so many books on 9/11." But, you know, I think with time, people have told me is that they felt it really actually captured the day itself. It takes place on 24 hours. It takes place on 9/11 itself, and it's a family that escapes downtown. They're one of the last cars to get over the bridge before the bridges and tunnels were closed after the planes hit the buildings, and it follows them in real time through that day. But it was really you know, I was seeing it as 9/11 being the bridge between the world before and the world after, and all the possibilities that came from that, you know. I mean, obviously 9/11 was this huge American tragedy, and those of us who lived through it will never forget it, and it's, you know, it's crippled us in so many ways, and I think it's led to a lot of very bad decisions that gave us the last decade. But at the time, at the very moment of 9/11, the weeks that followed, at least in New York, it was the most beautiful flowering of humanity I've ever witnessed. I've never seen such courage and generosity, and people were so good to each other. And
it makes the next decade even more depressing when you think about how the potential that was there at that point.
Well, that's how I feel. I feel like it was squandered, you know. I mean, so terribly that even our first responders have been treated so shabbily. I mean, it just breaks my heart. But at the time, I remember thinking people were rushing it down to, you know, ground zero to save strangers and risking their lives. I felt like they were doing it for me because I was a stranger too. They didn't know who it was. They were just doing it out of human goodness and compassion. Wow, that was something to see.
And something to write about, I guess.
I'm sorry?
And something to write about.
Yeah, it was. Well, I was profoundly moved by the whole experience, both for good and for ill, you know. And then what happened after that, that it just was squandered to me, was crushing.
Yeah.
I know a lot of Americans probably feel that way.
Well, I know I do. But on a lighter note, well, Helen Shulman, as a novelist, do you ever look at Amazon and see all the things people say about your stuff?
You know, I try not to keep track of things. I've had dark moments of the soul where I've taken a look, but I really try not to pay too much attention to all of that because it can rock you either way, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Just kind of do my work.
Well, how about as the... So you're the head of the MFA in creative writing there at the New School?
I run the fiction concentration. It really just means I run the fiction program, the master's program.
So what do you tell your students in terms of... let me just ask a broader question about that. Do you think you can teach creative writing?
Oh, you absolutely can. I mean, you know, I studied dance for years when I was a kid and a teenager, and you can teach ballet. You can't make somebody a great dancer. They have to have the drive and the discipline and the gift and the talent. I mean, there are things that they can give themselves, and there are things that only, you know, God or a God equivalent can give them as a gift. But you certainly can teach them so much in terms of... strategy and technique and how to finesse something and how to apprentice yourself to other great people who've come before you and what you can learn from them. And I think that's true in writing. And I think, you know, I've been doing it for so long now that I've had so many wonderful students who've gone on to write beautiful books. And I'm very proud of them. I also know that I'm not always sure who is going to be when I first meet them because so much of it is self-determined. I mean, the ones who work hard and stick with it do so much better. So I can help them with structure and I can help them with, you know, stylistic choices, sorry about that, and technique and all of that. And I can help them to really learn to read as a writer and become a good scavenger and a hunter for tricks and ideas. And, you know, I can't give them talent and I can't give them discipline.
Well, hopefully by the time they get to you, they've got some amount of talent, I guess.
Well, we try, you know, we're pretty selective. We try really hard to pick students who capture our eye and take somebody's breath away. It's, you know, it's an art, not a science, and as is the whole endeavor, you know. And then a lot of it is it's self-selecting group who apply because they want it so badly.
Right. Well, do you use your students? Did you let any of them read your work when you were crafting your? Who is your reader when you were crafting This Beautiful Life?
Well, for a long time I just write by myself.
Yep.
You know, I really need to have a good amount under my belt and feel, you know, pretty good about it before I show it to anyone. And then I show it to my husband, who he's a magazine editor and a journalist.
Mm-hmm.
And the first draft, I always say, lie to me and be nice. And then the second draft, I say, okay, give me what you can give me, you know. But, I mean, it's just so hard to bring it out into the open air. And then once he thinks it's in shape, I have a very close relationship with my agent, and I work very closely with him, and he's just about the toughest taskmaster there is. So when he gives me the go-ahead, I feel like I've gotten somewhere. And then after that, it's, you know, I've had many different editors at this point. I have a great one on this book, and I really love working with her. But it's years of just me, and then me and my husband, and then me and my agent.
Well, are you the kind of writer that writes it all out and then screws around with it, or do you, labor over every sentence and comma?
I'm a laborer. Mm-hmm. I mean, it takes me, I don't like to go forward until I get something right. But that doesn't mean that once I have a draft, I don't go back and pull it all apart again. I guess I do both.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, it's a lot of work.
And you have a lot of stories rattling around in your brain. I mean, you sort of indicated that a little while ago.
I do have a lot of stories rattling around my brain. I have things that I'm interested in. I mean, I definitely, you know, with my last two books, I had things I wanted to write about, and then a story presented itself to me, and from that, you know, like a little germ of an idea, I could then build a skeleton, a structural skeleton, in which to lay those ideas down. You know, it's not always the same way. Work changes. So my last two books were very realistic, hyper-real, practically, almost researched, in some ways researched, and before that, you know, they were kind of sideways to reality, and I had one book that was, you know, almost, not quite, not fantasy, but it had fantastical elements in it, so who knows? I certainly don't control it.
Have you started working on your next novel?
No, right now I'm writing a screenplay. A producer asked me to adapt a very short story that I wrote into screenplay form. The story is 2.5 pages. So it's a lot of making things up as I go, but it's really fun. And it's a much lighter subject, and that's just a relief after so many years of kind of dark story.
How long were you working on This Beautiful Life?
You know, I've stopped keeping track of things so much, but I was thinking about it before I started writing it, and I was working on A Day at the Beach. So I already had an idea in my head, and then A Day at the Beach came out in 2007, so it's got to be about 4 or 5 years, yeah.
Well, I hope we don't have to wait that long for your next thing.
Oh, thank you.
And maybe you'll come back and join us again on From the Bookshelf. Helen Shulman, and the book is called This Beautiful Life. Thanks so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, that's it for this week's edition of From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the program and that you'll come back and see us again next time. In the meantime, check out our podcast page at KUSP.org or find us on Facebook or subscribe to the podcasts on iTunes. I want to thank Helen Shulman for being my guest this week, her novel, This Beautiful Life. From the Bookshelf is aided and abetted by Francis Venegas. Thank you for all your help, Francis. Also, thanks this week to Donna Gould for helping put this show together. We'll see you again next time for From the Bookshelf. I'm Gary Shapiro.